This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 57th in a series of interviews with security gurus and other sorts, and I'm pleased to have with me today Eleanor Mills. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello.
Eleanor Mills is a senior writer at CNETnews.com, covering internet technology and security. She's been writing for 20 years on technology for a number of outlets, including Reuters, the Associated Press, the Industry Standard, and IDG. The 2010 Apollo Research Security Survey places Eleanor in the number one slot of journalists who, when writing about security, reach the largest audience. Eleanor has an MS in journalism from a school my spies could not find, though we did find out about Salon Medusa. And in addition to her blog on CNET, her Twitter feed, Eleanor Mills, and her persistent reporting, Eleanor has attended Burning Man for a decade, promises to fire dance at a future solstice party, and wrote Drama in the Desert in 2002. She lives in San Francisco. Edited Drama in the Desert in 2002. And she lives in San Francisco. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've written about technology during a very interesting time for lots of news organizations. How do the organization that you've worked for over the years differ from one another?
Oh, gosh. It started out in Associated Press, General News. Actually didn't do much writing about the technology there. The internet, early 90s, pre-80s, internet wasn't mainstream. Mm-hmm. Email wasn't mainstream. There was all, internal legacy sort of messaging systems and dumb terminals, and that was the computing experience for journalists. We'd have to actually call sources to get the information, go to call libraries to fact check. It was really different.
There was no Google.
Exactly. There was no Google. It was the local library. And then at IDG News Service, it was a wire service for all the IDG trade publications, and that was that's when I really first dove into technology reporting. Mm-hmm. And got on email, started dipping toes in the internet and the web, and then it just became like 5 years before 4 or 5 years, it was an invaluable tool that we could not do without.
Right. So how did that kind of change the culture of the newsroom and interactions with editors and all that stuff?
Well, initially, actually, one of my editors was a little bit leery about trusting the web because in the early days, it was the Wild West, and anyone could put up a web page if they knew some HTML, slap something up, call mm-hmm. themselves the New York Times or IBM, and put out false information. And,
it's kind of like apps on phones today.
Exactly. You could do what you want, and buyer or user beware. So there was a lot of doing both the old school, journalism reporting, calling people, double checking everything, and then also getting tips and using the internet in that way. And now we've come full bore to where too many journalists rely solely on what they see on the internet,
right?
Without confirming things.
Yep. So I suppose some of the biggest changes in journalism over the last 20 years involve the advent of blogging and Twitter and the demise of capable editors. So how's it been steering through those changes? Do you sort of find yourself, an island all by yourself these days? Did it used to be kind of a team and now it's kind of more individual effort?
It's really interesting. The whole media, journalism, it's all transformed into something completely, very, very much different. Not completely, totally different, but it's a new beast. So from, a lot of newspapers and a lot of news outlets are gone, mm-hmm. and the jobs that people have are scarcer, and there are more people competing for what journalism media jobs there are, mm-hmm. because now the blog format has kind of taken over, and there are fewer and fewer long-form features and big, you know, investigative stories and reports like that. Mm-hmm. It's moved towards, you know, short, punchy, fun, humorous blog posts, and then you move on to the next one. And, you know, if you can put a video in there and, you know, snapshots or, you know, whatever images, photos, you can quickly and get it up and move on to the next thing.
So, and you got to work Britney Spears into all the titles so that the Google search engine finds it.
Exactly. Make it sexy, Lady Gaga, you know. actually, for the tech world, Google and Apple, anything Apple and Google is almost, you know, like the equivalent to, you know, Paris Hilton or Justin Bieber.
You heard it here first. Apple is the equivalent of Paris Hilton. So my 16-year-old Jack loves Gizmodo. Is that reporting?
Yeah, it is. It is, definitely. They are they're getting tips. They're following up on stuff. They're covering, you know, breaking news. They're getting information out, and they're doing it at an incredibly fast pace.
Mm-hmm.
They get a lot of, you know, anonymous tips and stuff. Was it them or Engadget that got the iPhone?
I think it was them. Wasn't it Gizmodo Gate?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, There's this pressure to be first, to break stories, and a lot of times there isn't a lot of you know, second day or third day, you know, analysis that might be needed to really give the context and the full story.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of blog sites don't call both sides for comment, and a lot of blog posts again, I'm not singling anyone out at all.
Mm-hmm.
In general, I'm talking just blog sites that are sort of the new media. Are just sort of reiterating what everyone else has covered.
Right.
You know, and
right.
I'm not saying, you know, we don't do some of that, and everyone has to do it. There are certain things you just have to have, and you want to have for the record. But it makes it hard. You know, you want to follow up with something. You don't know, you know, you want to verify,
mm-hmm.
but then everyone else is already reporting it. Well, if you don't get something up, but then if you get it up and it's not right, then you're wrong.
Yeah,
but then everyone's
wrong. And then the blog entries move around and people retract stuff and cross out lines, and it's, yeah, interesting.
Exactly.
So in many respects, security is like a bunch of grumpy old men. And with the advent of Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and so on, we've seen the rise of what we call the lifestyle hacker. This is 20-somethings versus the establishment. You've covered security issues around these technologies. So what's your opinion about, you know, security and privacy and all of these social media things that are pervading the planet?
Okay, well, I would say that also there's Okay, when you talk about a lifestyle hacker, actually, the grumpy old hackers, it's been interesting to watch the hackers, whether it's the kids who, you know, were doing the graffiti on the websites in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. I'm thinking of the
grumpy old men as the CSO of a corporation who says something like, okay, all you 20-year-olds, I know you love Facebook, but forget it. You're working at a bank now.
Ah, so you're not talking about security professionals. You're talking about just the professional world and how they're viewing the use of technology.
Yeah,
for
and to
employees.
Some extent, some of those executives are security professionals at the CIO, CSO
right.
level.
Well, everyone's using Facebook and Twitter. I mean, and many, many people are using Twitter. I mean, the lines between work and personal lives are blurred.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just more avenues, even more avenues that people inside of corporations and organizations are, you know, leaking information or opening doorways for viruses or other types of, you know, targeted and other attacks. And
mm-hmm.
it's a changed world because of this. And people posting so much information about themselves on these sites, it's just ludicrous. And
I think they sometimes don't. Yeah, they don't realize that never goes away.
No, it doesn't.
You know, you apply for a job and then somebody Googles up some crazy images that you posted to whatever.
I think we're going to see more companies or efforts pop up that are designed to, educate people about how much of their digital persona is you know, accessible or public, mm-hmm. and B, help them clean it up.
Absolutely. Like the erasers, yeah.
Yeah, Reputation Defender is one company in the Bay Area or South Bay that does, you know, that kind of stuff. And then Intellius, which is a company where you can do people searches and people go there to do background checks. And,
yep.
you know, they get a lot of, you know, a lot of action there.
I think it should be even further than that. You should be able to just apply for any sort of background you want and have them just make it up and get it all cross-posted nicely as if it's been out there for 10 years.
That would be great. That would be fiction. I'd love that.
Yeah, well, the internet.
I'd like to make up my own.
That's what I was thinking.
That's another thing. Just create a bunch of Eleanor Millses in different cities and different, you know, occupations. And,
oh, believe me, when I was doing my background research for this podcast, there are plenty of Eleanor Millses. And Eleanor is spelled in many different ways.
That's right. I like to keep everyone guessing, right?
So tell us about your experience with self-publishing when you did the Raised Barn Press stuff or worked with them versus leveraging the amazing reach of CNET and, you know, kind of what that's like. Because it seems like things are trending in that direction-ish.
The personal branding, the journalist who was behind the byline, you know, you never saw a picture, you didn't know who it was. Or how they worked or anything about, you know, about them as a person. You just read bylines.
Mm-hmm.
Has become now front and center. Like, you know, faces all over the blog sites, you know, on TV getting interviewed,
yep.
Branding themselves all over Twitter and Facebook. You know, it's really interesting how, you know, how journalists are now branding themselves.
Well, you might say print journalism devolved to TV journalism.
Yeah.
Because that happened
definitely.
In TV a long time ago.
Absolutely, that's what's happening. So, so people who have, you know, their side projects, there's a mix of using both. I was one of the main editors on that book project
mm-hmm.
Before I joined CNET, and I did not. I kept it totally separate from the Industry Standard and or Reuters, wherever, you know, I think I was working maybe both places when it was going on.
Yeah.
You know, so, and there, you know, there wasn't Twitter and Facebook then, and there was, you know, there was no opportunity to do that. But a friend I'd been going for a number of years, since 95, and one of my friends had been taking photographs, you know, every year. And she had just an amazing collection of photographs of the art and the city and how it's transformed. And so we did a book of her photographs,
mm-hmm.
and then we solicited contributions, essays, poems, just any kind of text, and to go with those photographs, and created a book. And then there was a DVD with video that accompanied it, and it was a great project with a bunch of friends.
So how did it feel to sort of self-publish versus having some sort of gigantic media machine, you know, doing whatever it does to promote a product?
Talk about grassroots and scrambling for money and, you know, just, you know, putting stuff on credit cards. And I'm not talking about me personally. I just volunteered.
Uh-huh.
But Holly Kreuter, who was, you know, is the artist and the one, you know, the one who launched the whole project and created Raised Barn Press, that was her. She was really doing it. It was a one-woman, you know, business with volunteer friends trying to help out, and it was truly grassroots. Now, if that was before Blurb and Lulu, I guess, is the other one, you know, online publishing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it might be easier now, and we might have done things differently rather than, you know, trying to find a, you know, an affordable publisher in Singapore and then having to go out there and check, you know, how the ink came out and,
right.
you know, this and that, the printing. I mean, it really was by the shoestring.
Cool.
When we did it.
Cool. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So you mentioned Reuters. While you were a foreign correspondent for Reuters, you lived in Portugal. And besides a fascination with Fado and Ronaldo's pecs, how does technology and its adoption differ in that culture than from the States?
They are heavy phone users, and they were all over the text messaging. When I left, it was early 2004, and it didn't seem like there was a lot of text messaging going on. Like, I didn't know anyone who was doing it. We were still, you know, for me, it was like, yeah, okay, great, I have a cell phone. That's the 21st century.
Well, you should and see then, the teenagers these days, man.
Oh,
like Eli,
he
doesn't do any emailing at all. He just does text. That's it. If you send him an email, it'll languish. So if you send him an email, you have to send him an SMS and say, check your email.
Email is so 1990s.
1985. Come on. It's even before 1990.
It's true. But 90s is when it went mainstream. But you're right. Yeah, it's about text messaging. And who knows what, you know, next it's going to be just some, you know, whatever, Twitter or Facebook, you know, communication or...
Well, it is some sort of mashup. There are all sorts of amazing mashups for the iPad now. And that's what Jack does.
Yeah, that's very exciting. Getting it all into one place that's lightweight and portable. I like that.
Yeah, even fewer editors involved. Yeah.
Exactly.
We don't need no editors.
Yeah, there are actually, I lament the demise of the editor and the second read, you know, before copy goes out to the public.
I write too, and I miss that too. It was nice to have somebody else go, what do you mean?
But there's no time. You got to get it out now. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you don't, someone's going to, you know, whatever.
So let's talk about WikiLeaks a little bit. WikiLeaks is all over the news this month. I'm sure that you're covering this in your writing, and the politics are getting really pretty fierce. So some people believe that Assange is being unfairly targeted and that freedom of the press is on the wane in America. And, you know, you see all sorts of things on both sides of the political spectrum on this stuff. But I have a question. Do you think WikiLeaks is a media outlet as defined in legal terms? Like, ultimately, you have freedom of the press, but is WikiLeaks part of the press? What do you think?
That's a good question. I think it is really it's a good question. You know, the press in the U.S. at least, you know, it's the fourth estate, holding the other, you know, pillars accountable to the public, providing information and informing the public so they can, know what their leaders are doing. In that sense, I don't know.
Well, so we can look at the Pentagon Papers and the New York Times, or we can look at Watergate and the Washington Post. But somehow, when you set the same sort of Kleeg-likes up against WikiLeaks, it just doesn't look the same. And the real question I have is about, you know, when you go to the legal standings, when you talk to the court of law, how would they define WikiLeaks, and would it be a media outlet? And I think the whole question of what our stance should be about that story hinges on that really important question. Nobody's talking about that.
Especially since so many new sort of mixed op-ed opinion websites that are now blogs, that are now, you know, journalists. I mean, you know, even with the... who was it that got suspended? It was Olbermann got suspended for
donating to Democrats.
Yeah, to the Democrats. Yeah. And he is a journalist, and you know, so did he cross a line? And at first they said he did, but then he's more of a a presenter, not so much covering the news.
And then they said, wow, crossing the line is good. It gets you lots of ink and hits.
Yeah. The lines are so blurred, and it's kind of up for anyone's interpretation. As far as WikiLeaks, that would be, you know, it'd be interesting to see what the courts would say. I'm inclined to say that, you know, with the conservatism of a lot of our courts, that they would probably side with the government.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting, because it means as the mass media, as we used to know it in the 70s and 80s, morphs into whatever the heck it's become and still becoming, then freedom of the press will erode necessarily. So the definition's pretty important, I think.
It is. And can the definition be changed? I mean, how malleable is...
Well, the law is very malleable, so the definition can be changed, but it takes legal precedence. So,
unless you're talking about gun rights.
We're not going there. This is Silver Bullet, and we don't talk about guns. So... Another question. You cover...
But it's Silver Bullet.
It's that we've covered the guns. Yep. We're all set. So you cover the security problem of the day beat, which gets a bit relentless, I'm sure. And you've has covering things like Fire Sheep changed your own net behavior in any way, or do you just sort of compartmentalize and go, whatever, these people are all insane and I have to keep doing my life normally?
No, I do. I try and keep my personal paranoia to a minimum.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can't try and keep it in check, but I do, when I hear about these things and alternately find out, you know, what's the best sort of, if there is a technology, you know, some kind of tool, whether it's, you know, Firefox, NoScript plugin or, you know, whatever, I try and immediately use those tools on the Windows machine I use at work.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a Mac at home.
Right.
And I even have antivirus on that. So, yes, I do, you know, download all these things, and I try and use as much protection as I can.
Uh-huh.
But I don't let it keep me up. But a lot of these things are not, you know, like NoScript is not all that. I mean, I spend a lot more time clicking on, you know, deciding and, you know, clicking on whether I want to allow this page or certain items on this page. It's not a lot. Some of the stuff I use is not for the regular user.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't tell, you know, my mother or, you know, neighbor to use these necessarily.
Well, when you turn NoScript on, a lot of stuff breaks. It's just like, you know, you ever try using the browser, the Safari browser on the iPad? And it doesn't support Adobe stuff, and so half the stuff on the net just doesn't work. We do a lot of cursing of Steve Jobs around our kitchen table these days because of that.
Yeah, I bet.
Thanks, Steve. Hope you're listening. So a little more seriously, you were among the very few reporters who covered Stuxnet properly, in my view, focusing on payload versus delivery, for example. And so the question is, how do you avoid the fog, the FUD, the sand spinmeisters when a major story like Stuxnet is breaking?
You know, it's really hard because sometimes there's not enough information or details initially to know really how serious it is. So it could be some, you know, it's a new thing, and it seems like it could be really serious. And it's really hard with Stuxnet. It kind of revealed itself to be pretty serious, you know, shortly after it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And the Windows thing was sort of a distraction that you had to just sort of put to the side and mention it in stories because that's the way it spreads, but that's really not why it's important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the minute they said, you know, it's the first to target industrial control systems, boom, that right there, that's huge. And it has continued to be an important story and will continue to be, especially given the fact that there could be, you know, the capabilities for copycats to target other, you know, plants and other types of operations.
Absolutely. Well, you'd already done that interview with Joe Weiss, who, mm-hmm. you know, many people thought Joe was a little off his rocker, but it turns out he was just plain old right and a little ahead of his time. And
I wanted to use the word Cassandra for him.
Well, that's right, but unfortunately nobody knows that Cassandra turned out to be right. Nobody knows
that's
their mythology. They all think Cassandra equals whiner.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but he is the Cassandra. We can say it here because Silver Bullet listeners are much smarter than that. So the genie is out of the bottle for control systems, but you know, you already knew that it was possible to get out of that bottle, and many people who think about security all day knew that too. I guess it's just the wider realization that it's real that makes it so interesting. What do you think?
Well, when something has become public, so a lot of stuff is happening that we don't know about. It's just not reported. It's not public. This becoming public, it's the first, you know, when it's the first that's publicly reported,
mm-hmm.
that's the red flag right there. And it proved what Joe was saying. You know, it's no longer, you know, a possibility. It's reality. And that is scary.
Right.
To have the IT, you know, the concerns we have in the IT world on the desktop, you know, and in servers now, it's
nuclear power plants and electric grid systems and cars.
We're talking life and death here.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we're talking, you know, not just stealing corporate, you know, credit card numbers and corporate espionage.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that makes the guys with the tinfoil hats seem a little bit less crazy, even though, you know, tinfoil's not going to do them any good. So a little bit lighter. After a decade of Burning Man events, I guess you've gone to it for 10 years now, or is it still 9?
Oh, my first year was 95, and I think since then I've missed 3 or 4.
Uh-huh.
So 12 years, probably.
Holy cow. So what is it about the annual but somehow ephemeral gathering that's so attractive to techies and artists and the digerati, you think?
Creating your reality. You know, it's a blank slate, okay? And challenges. Creating a city, or you're part of the city, whether it's, you know, an art car or a performance or some kind of crazy, you know, kinetic digital sculpture out there in a desert with no off the grid.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that techies are really attracted to the challenge of that,
mm-hmm.
and to the messing, distorting of reality. You know, you think, you know, you're going to go desert camping, and you get out there, and it's amazing. It's a mini metropolis,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of bright lights at night and very complex structures, and, you know, things that make you cold when it's hot outside, or just entertain you and delight you. I mean, it's the biggest art gallery in the world.
Very cool.
It's a playground for anyone and everyone.
So what do you think, there's a relationship between, say, cyberspace and avatars and creating your own reality in that way, that, you know, this is a physical world analog of that?
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, and that is an extension of San Francisco, too. Like, it's very San Francisco, that sense of, creating an alter ego. A lot of people, there are quite a few people here who just assume new names.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you know, I'm going to become Gaia, you know? So then...
I think that one's taken.
Burning,
yeah.
Definitely. It's way, way overdone. But, you know, they become a new persona on the playa, which is what we call, you know, the desert out there.
Yes.
And create their own reality.
Yeah.
It's a conceptual thing. It's not just a physical. It's conceptual. What can you do to really shake things up?
Sounds
fun.
I've always wanted to go, but it's just so far away from us East Coast people. You know, we're so staid over here.
I know. Well, it's worth checking out. Maybe you can combine it with some security event out here. You know, write it off. Gee, what's this receipt for, you know, an RV that's covered in dust?
Right.
What's, you know, all these beers? What's that about?
Seems unlikely, but let's stop talking about the tactics here on a podcast. So last and most important question of all, what's your favorite novel that you read in 2010?
Eating Animals.
Hmm.
Jonathan Safran Foer is by far my favorite writer right now. Everything is Illuminated was his first novel.
Yep.
And his second one, I think you know what it is, and I always forget the title because it's one of those that's long and crazy and not easy to remember. Extremely Loud and Up Close, or Extremely Close and Very Up... Oh, shoot, I can't remember it. But
the Google knows. We'll ask the Google later, so there'll be a link.
He's a great writer, and his new one is totally different. It's nonfiction. It's about our whole experience of, you know, eating animals, whether we should, or the ethics around that, and alternatives. It's amazing.
So you cheated a little, because I said favorite novel, and that's nonfiction.
Oh.
Yeah, so you get a whole nother answer if you want.
Oh, wow. Okay, favorite novel. Well, I really loved Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections, which a good friend loaned me recently, and that was fantastic. I really got engrossed with that. I can't say maybe necessarily that it was my favorite of the year, but it's high up there.
Well, you know, the year's not over yet, so there's still, I don't know, 20 days left, right, almost, to read more stuff and come up with a favorite. Thanks very much. It's been interesting.
All right. Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by InformIT. The November-December issue of IEEE S&P features a roundtable discussion of cloud computing and security with representatives from Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Cisco, and the Cloud Security Alliance. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.